Iran's president says the presence of foreigners in West Asia increases in security, stressing regional cooperation will lead to peace and security. U.S. warns its citizens to avoid traveling to the UAE following recent drone and missile attacks by the Yemeni army against Abu Dhabi. And the Venezuelan opposition fails to collect a minimum number of signatures required for a recall referendum against President Nicolas Maduro. Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to World News. In our top story, the Iranian president has expressed concern over the presence of foreigners in West Asia, warning such presence only increases insecurity in the region. Ebrahim Raisi stressed the importance of cooperation among regional countries for the insurance of security and peace. He noted that such cooperation is also beneficial for the progress of regional nations. Raisi made the remarks in a meeting with the Qatari foreign minister in Tehran. Mohammed bin Abdulrahman Al-Thani also echoed the Iranian president's stance on regional cooperation, noting the presence of foreign forces will have adverse consequences for the region. The Qatari official is on an official visit to Iran for a series of high-level meetings on regional issues. He met with his Iranian counterpart, Hossein Amir Abdullahian, earlier on Thursday. Political commentator Sarah Flounder says U.S. has a policy of dividing and impoverishing the West Asia region, which is part of its colonial mentality.
This is a colonial mentality. And certainly the United States knows that every country in the region wants them out. And Iran has every right to open up bilateral relations with each country. And many countries literally need it for survival, because one by one, U.S. policy is to divide them, to sanction them, to separate them from each other, to try to impoverish the entire region, to make each country dependent on U.S. imperialism and its allies. And when you consider U.S. sanctions on Iran, but also on Iraq, on Syria, on Lebanon, Yemen, into the Horn of Africa, Ethiopia, Eritrea, Sudan, South Sudan. Regionally, this is the big problem, that every country is under attack, is under sanctions, is under U.S. bases, naval bases, military bases in the region. So that resistance is growing, and Iran is a force for stability in the region.
Iran's deputy UN envoy once again calls for the removal of inhumane sanctions on Syria, saying unlawful measures prolong the suffering of the Syrian people. In an address to the UN Security Council, Zahra Ershadi says unilateral sanctions against Syria have adversely affected the work of international and national humanitarian agencies in the country. She says the key to alleviate the suffering is to maintain country sovereignty and territorial integrity. To that end, the Iranian envoy has called on countries that are illegally present in Syria to end their occupation. She also called for an end to aggression of Israeli regime against the Arab country. The Syrian military prosecution says it's obtained and documented evidence of numerous U.S. violations in Syria during the years-long war. It's also vowed to judicially pursue all Americans who committed crimes or undermined the state's sovereignty. Muhammad Ali reports from Damascus.
It's what occupation looks like. U.S. troops wander around an independent country without any legal justification, invitation, or U.N. mandate. The U.S. officially intervened in Syria in 2014 under the pretext of fighting Daesh, something Syria dismisses as lies. The military prosecution in Syria held a press conference asserting it has collected evidence of U.S.-Daesh cooperation in Syria. The military prosecution in Syria obtained material evidence that the U.S. has almost direct control over Daesh and its terrorist activities in Syria using its illegal base in Al-Tanf. We have proof that many Daesh terrorists are being trained by U.S. forces in that base. We monitor the terrorists moving freely there with their weapons and vehicles.
For years, the U.S. has been looting Syria's oil after occupying areas in the oil-rich north and northeastern territories. The military prosecution in Syria vowed to judicially pursue the U.S. for all its crimes.
The result of our investigations into the U.S. violations in Syria, which led to destruction and casualties, threat to our sovereignty, theft of oil and wheat, illegitimate sanctions, and control over Daesh on territories of a U.N. member state, enables us in the near future to officially make accusations against the U.S. administration and its forces in Syria.
The military prosecution also accused the U.S. of promoting division by supporting a separatist ideology among the so-called SDF, providing them with weapons and ensuring they get all Syria's oil, let alone the U.S. airstrikes, which killed or displaced thousands of Syrians and destroyed its infrastructure. It hasn't been a day or two, a month or a year. It's been almost 8 uninterrupted years of U.S. violations in Syria, at least since the intervention of the U.S.-led coalition. But regardless of how much time they're planning to stay, Syrian officials don't spare a chance to reiterate that their country will be liberated from terrorism and illegal foreign presence. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
Iran has called on the UN to take immediate measures to halt the killing of defenseless Yemenis by the Saudi-led coalition. In a letter to the UN representative for Yemen, a senior advisor to Iran's foreign minister says that Tehran condemns the bombings of cities, civilian buildings, and infrastructure in Yemen. Ali Asghar Khaji said Saudi-led coalition's atrocities run counter to international laws. He says the Yemen's crisis has no military solution. The Iranian diplomat also has called for the lifting of a Saudi-imposed blockade on the country that's exacerbated Yemen's humanitarian crisis. The Saudi-led coalition has carried out dozens of deadly airstrikes on Yemen this week. In one such attack, more than 90 people were killed when coalition warplanes bombed a prison in Yemen. Meanwhile, a group of protesters have gathered outside the UN office in Tehran, condemning recent Saudi airstrikes in Yemen, which killed dozens of civilians. Protesters are demanding the UN take action to end the ongoing Saudi war on its southern neighbor. Yusuf Jalali has your story.
Stop the Saudi war on Yemen. This is what these protesters demand as they gathered outside the United Nations office in Tehran. The rally came in reaction to last week's deadly airstrikes by the Saudi-led coalition that targeted a detention facility in Yemen. The United Nations did express its concern for the escalation of the conflict, but protesters here say it's not enough.
We gathered in front of the UN office to say that all of the crimes that are being committed against civilians are happening because the United Nations has given the Saudi criminals a green light by staying silent and watching.
For 7 years, the Yemeni nation has been facing the cruelest blockade and deadliest airstrikes, but no one is doing anything to help the Yemenis.
This time, besides targeting innocent people, Saudi Arabia also targeted the internet infrastructure to prevent their crimes from being reflected to the world. So we are the voices of our Yemeni brothers and sisters, and we are here to tell the world about the Saudi crimes.
Saudi Arabia and its regional allies launched the war on Yemen in March 2015 with the goal of bringing former Yemeni President Abdurrabbuh Mansour Hadi back to power. Yemen's Ansarullah movement, along with the army, leads the anti-Saudi resistance in the country. These people say, despite Riyadh's strong logistic support from the U.S. and U.K., Yemen has made headways against the Saudi invaders and left the kingdom and its allies bogged down in the country.
The enemy is facing a hard time. Saudi Arabia tried its best and plundered its money on American and British weapons to bring our nation to its knees. But our resistance has burst their bubble, and as you see, they are resorting to barbaric ways to achieve their evil goals. But we keep resisting until our land is free.
The ongoing bombardment of civilian facilities has left hundreds of thousands of Yemenis dead and destroyed the infrastructure of the impoverished country, not to mention the spread of infectious diseases and famine. Saudi Arabia has also imposed an all-out blockade against Yemen, which blocks the entry of humanitarian and medical supplies into the war-torn country.
The Saudi war on Yemen is slammed here as a crime against humanity, a crime that these people say continues to be ignored by the responsible entities in the world. Protesters here say it's time for the UN to do more than condemning the crimes committed by Riyadh and take action to bring the Yemeni suffering to an end. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
U.S. has warned its citizens against traveling to the United Arab Emirates, citing the threat of missile or drone attacks. This is the highest level of travel advisory issued by the State Department. It says the possibility of attacks affecting U.S. citizens and interests remains an ongoing and serious concern. Washington had already urged Americans against traveling to the UAE because of COVID. Latest warning follows recent retaliatory drone and missile attacks by the Yemeni army against major Emirati cities. Attacks were in response to relentless bombings of Yemen by a Saudi-led coalition in which the UAE is an active partner. The Yemeni army has warned it will further strike if the UAE does not stop its war campaign against Yemen. Venezuela's National Electoral Commission has rejected a request for a referendum on President Nicolas Maduro, citing lack of signatures for a recall vote. Now, the commission gave Maduro's opponents 12 hours on Wednesday to collect a minimum of 4.2 million signatures from the country's eligible voters, but efforts could receive only 1% of the country's 21 million-strong voter registry. On Thursday, the council announced that Maduro's opponents failed to collect enough signatures to proceed with a referendum on his presidency. Venezuela's constitution allows officials who have completed at least half of their term to be removed from office by a vote. The U.S. Drinking water supplies are absolutely vulnerable to large-scale disruption by hackers. That's according to a senior American official. Official warned the cyber defenses for the country's water supplies are absolutely inadequate to deal with hackers. He added, threshold of resilience is not what it needs to be. The official expressed concern that a cyber attack could disable or manipulate water treatment processes and could even stop the flow of water supplies. Some officials enrolled a plan to get water companies to work with the government to shore up security gaps. There are an estimated 150,000 water systems serving 300 million Americans. Thousands of French workers have gone on strike demanding a salary rise amid a hike in the cost of living. Workers from heavy industry, transport, farming, and public services, as well as teachers, are taking part in the strikes. France's major labor union, the CGT, says over 170 demonstrations and marches have been held across the country. Industrial action has also disrupted regional train services in the capital, Paris. France experienced an inflation rate of 2.8% over the course of 2021. The country's workers' unions have criticized the government for failing to introduce a boost to the minimum wage over the past year. The controversial Nationality and Borders Bill is still causing a stir in Britain as the government seeks to grant itself more powers to revoke citizenship without having to inform the person in advance. Critics fear that the bill empowers racism and makes minorities vulnerable to state persecution and authoritarianism. Robert Carter explains.
Protests against a highly divisive bill have intensified in London as debates rage inside Westminster. The Nationality and Borders Bill has several controversial clauses which minority groups have accused of being racist and turning black and brown Brits into second-class citizens.
The fight over this clause is far from over. It remains in the House of Lords, who are debating the various controversial clauses which remain as part of this wide bill. Now, there is a lot of division to various clauses, and if the Lords decide that they want amendments to it, it will bounce back to Parliament.
The bill seeks to provide the Home Office with additional powers to revoke citizens' nationality status and deny access to refugees fleeing to Britain. The government have offered reassurances, with Home Secretary Priti Patel claiming the law would be used only in exceptional circumstances on people who pose the most risk to the UK. But critics find it hard to trust Number 10.
Trust is something that needs to be earned. It's not a right for the government to assume that they're going to have trust from its citizens, especially when they're putting something in which is so vague that it leaves too many interpretations open.
Priti Patel is actually quite a disgrace to her ancestors. As a migrant, she knows that she came from the backs of those who were colonized by the system. And now you create a bill to oppress those? I think that's pretty fascist for me. And just because she's got a little bit of power, she's forgotten who she's made from, where she comes from. And just because she sits with some people with privilege, I'm using my privilege to use it to create a change for other people. What is she doing?
Having been passed by MPs in the House of Commons last December, the bill is now going through the House of Lords, where peers are suggesting amendments. The bill likely won't become law for the next few months, leaving plenty of time for further protests. Robert Carter, London.
North Korea has confirmed its latest missile launches amid growing tensions with the United States over the country's nuclear weapons program. State media KCNA said one of the tests was an upgraded long-range cruise missile and the other a warhead of tactical guided missile. On Wednesday, the South Korean military said it detected the launch of two short-range ballistic missiles. Launches drew condemnation from the U.S. North Korea has recently said it will bolster its defenses against the U.S. and consider resuming all temporarily suspended activities. Now, Sudanese forces have killed another protester in the capital Khartoum during a rally against the October coup and a military-dominated transitional government. According to the Central Committee of Sudanese Doctors, 78 people have now been killed during demonstrations since the October 25th military coup. People are regularly taking to the streets to vent their anger since the military takeover and the detention of civilian leaders, including then Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok. Hamdok was later released and reinstated under a deal, but later resigned earlier this month. And thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Americans like to think of their nation as a beacon of freedom, and despite all the ways in which we have failed to live up to our self-image, above all the vast injustices that spring from the original sin of slavery, freedom Not just free elections, but also freedom of speech and thought has long been a key element of the American idea. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times opinion columnist Paul Krugman. Krugman is a professor at the City University of New York Graduate Center, and he won the 2008 Nobel Memorial Prize in Economic Sciences. The piece is titled Attack of the Right-Wing Thought Police. Americans like to think of their nation as a beacon of freedom, and despite all the ways in which we have failed to live up to our self-image, above all the vast injustices that sprang from the original sin of slavery, freedom, not just free elections but also freedom of speech and thought, has long been a key element of the American idea. Now, however, freedom is under attack on more fronts than many people realize. Everyone knows about the big lie, the refusal by a large majority of Republicans to accept the legitimacy of a lost election. But there are many other areas in which freedom is not just under assault, but in retreat. Let's talk in particular about the attack on education, especially, but not only, in Florida, which has become one of America's leading laboratories of democratic erosion. Republicans have made considerable political hay by denouncing the teaching of critical race theory. This strategy has succeeded, even though most voters have no idea what that theory is, and it isn't actually being taught in public schools. But the facts in this case don't matter, because denunciations of critical race theory are basically a cover for a much bigger agenda. An attempt to stop schools from teaching anything that makes right-wingers uncomfortable. I use that last word advisedly. There's a bill advancing in the Florida Senate declaring that an individual should not be made to feel discomfort, guilt, anguish, or any other form of psychological distress on account of his or her race. That is, the criterion for what can be taught in schools isn't, is it true? Is it supported by the scholarly consensus? But rather, does it make certain constituencies uncomfortable? Anyone tempted to place an innocuous interpretation on this provision, maybe it's just about not assigning collective guilt, should read the text of the bill. Among other things, it cites as its two prime examples of things that must not happen in schools, denial or minimization of the Holocaust, and the teaching of critical race theory. Because suggesting that racism is embedded in American society, the bill's definition of critical race theory is just the same as denying that Hitler killed 6 million Jews. What's really striking, however, is the idea that schools should be prohibited from teaching anything that causes discomfort among students and their parents. If you imagine that the effects of applying this principle would be limited to teaching about race relations, you're being utterly naive. For one thing, racism is far from being the only disturbing topic in American history. I'm sure that some students will find that the story of how we came to invade Iraq, or for that matter, how we got involved in the Vietnam War, makes them uncomfortable. Ban those topics from the curriculum. Then there's the teaching of science. Most high schools do teach the theory of evolution, but leading Republican politicians are either evasive or actively deny the scientific consensus, presumably reflecting the GOP's base discomfort with the concept of evolution. Once the Florida standard takes hold, how long will teaching of evolution survive? Geology, by the way, has the same problem. I've been on nature tours where the guides refused to talk about the origins of rock formations, saying that they've had problems with some religious guests. Oh, and given the growing importance of anti-vaccination posturing as a badge of conservative allegiance, how long before basic epidemiology, maybe even the germ theory of disease, gets the critical race theory treatment? And then there's economics, which these days is widely taught at high school level. Given the long history of politically driven attempts to prevent the teaching of Keynesian economics, what do you think the Florida Standard would do to teaching in my home field? The point is that the smear campaign against critical race theory is almost certainly the start of an attempt to subject education in general to rule by the right-wing thought police, which will have dire effects far beyond the specific topic of racism. And who will enforce the rules? State-sponsored vigilantes. Last month, Ron DeSantis, Florida's governor, proposed a Stop Woke Act that would empower parents to sue school districts they claim teach critical race theory and collect lawyer fees, a setup modeled under bounties under Texas's new anti-abortion law. Even the prospect of such lawsuits would have a chilling effect on teaching. Did I mention that Ron DeSantis also wants to create a special police force to investigate election fraud? Like the attacks on critical race theory, this is obviously an attempt to use a made-up issue, voter fraud is largely non-existent, as an excuse for intimidation. Okay, I'm sure that some people will say that I'm making too much of these issues, but ask yourself this. Has there been any point over, say, the last 5 years when warnings about right-wing extremism have proved overblown, and those dismissing those warnings as alarmists have been right?
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special, and I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of Muslim Lady. It is an honor and a pleasure to have you all with us. And of course, as always, I have the privilege of hosting my wonderful sister and awesome expert, Sister Razia Shamili. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, my full of energy friend.
Throughout these last few episodes, we've been talking about how to equip our girls with the mindset and skill set, basically, that they need in order to carry out their roles and responsibilities as adults.
So we were talking about the Quran attracts our attention to the topic of haya. I was actually reading a hadith from Lady Fatima, salamullah alayha, that she says, a woman is someone who does not see a non-mahram and a non-mahram does not see her.
That's the best thing for a woman.
That is the best thing for a woman. I was with a traditional practitioner one day, and she was saying that there are some physiological impacts, you know, coming with the eyes, you know, the energy that you send and the energy that you receive. I call it energy, but I don't know if I'm using the right term. But when you are with a non-mahram man, it affects the psychology of your body. your energy, the power of your eyes, your sexual
waves,
drive, yeah. everything, it impacts it. Mm. The priority in all of us Muslim women's lives is that if it's possible for us to have this interaction with the non-mahram to the limited possible level, right?
Mm.
And if it's possible to have it no interactions with the non-mahram. But then, of course, the concept of hijab is there that if you do have to go to the society, if you do have to interact, interact to the minimum and, you know, cover your beauties and whatever that lies there. But these are all fruits of the upbringing of instilling haya in a person, right? It starts from a much younger age, before the time of conception,
mm.
right? It starts with the food that the parents have eaten, if it is from halal money or not. So
Absolutely.
Haya, the concept of modesty or chastity, starts from back then.
Mm-hmm.
And then all the way through the time that the mother is pregnant with her fetus and how she thinks, how she feels, what she eats, where she goes, what she listens to,
mm.
who she socializes with. All this have an impact on all the dimensions of that child, and including the modesty, the level of the modesty, right? No wonder they say that a person is shaqi in the womb of its mother, and a person is sa'id or prosperous
mm.
in the womb of its mother, right? So
yeah.
everything, like the core of everything is there.
Yeah.
So shaqi means
wretched.
Mm. Against opposite of sa'id, which is prosperous and happy and content.
Felicitous, yeah.
right. The third level, when the child is born, they say that an adult couple who are having an intimate relationship together, even the sound of it should not be heard by a newborn
yeah.
child,
mm-hmm.
as it affects the level of his or her chastity, mm-hmm. right? So you see, Islam has very detailed guidelines about instilling haya in a person.
For sure.
Later on, when that child grows up, there's this beautiful verse in the Noble Quran that it says that you, as the parents, both of you, are responsible in telling your child what are your red boundaries. There are certain areas that are private to you, mom and dad, and your child will have to learn. And we're talking about 1400 years ago.
Mm.
It's not right now that there's this private realm of life, right? It is in chapter Nur, verse number 58, where it says, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم يا أيها الذين آمنوا. O you who have faith. Two categories of people, your slaves, the people who work for you in your home, and any of you who have not reached puberty, so your children, will have to seek your permission 3 times in a day.
No, by that, the verse doesn't mean that once they reach puberty, they don't have to ask permission anymore.
No. It says that these people will have to, the verse is going to answer your
mm-hmm.
question. It says before the dawn prayer,
mm-hmm.
when you put off your garments at noon,
mm-hmm.
after the night prayer. I'm assuming that after the night prayer, after the Isha prayer, people in the past used to recline and go to bed,
mm-hmm.
right? In the middle of the night, they would wake up for nightly vigils,
mm-hmm.
and then they would go to sleep again and have their private moments until it was the time of dawn. So after the Isha, you had to ask permission.
Mm-hmm.
And then before the dawn, you also have to... This is the period that... parents are in the bedroom and they want to have their privacy.
Mm.
And you have to teach your child that when you want to enter, knock at the door.
You're listening to Muslim Lady and we're discussing the practical steps of instilling haya and modesty per the teachings of Islam. However, we're going to be back after a short break, so stay with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Muslim Lady, and we are talking about some interesting stuff on today's episode of the show. Thank you for joining us.
Aside from the 2 times that the children will have to knock at the door and ask permission from the parents because they are They have taken off their clothes. They're comfortable in their bedroom. And it's a sign of showing respect to parents and their privacy. And then these are three times of privacy for you. Apart from these, it is not sinful of you or them to frequent one another freely without asking permission to enter. But the question that if you have reached maturity, you would have to ask permission every time during the day where you want to enter your parents' room. Mm. But if you haven't reached maturity, these three specific moments, you have to ask permission. This is the fourth stage where you are raising your child and you are teaching him or her how to dress. Another stage where you have to teach your daughter about the concept of haya is that according to our hadith, hugging and kissing a girl has to be done with care and precaution, right?
Of course.
It's not like the girl is 14 and you're like, oh, this is my uncle. It's okay. He can see me without hijab. He has seen me growing up from a very young age.
Not her actual uncle.
No.
Because her actual uncle is okay.
Yeah. I think it was in the presence of one of the imams. I think it was fifth or sixth imam where a fellow man hugged a 5 or 6 year old girl, and the imam told him that you know, it's now that she's growing up, you're not allowed to kiss her and put her on your lap which you used to do. These are instilling chastity and modesty into the girls. Also, the other point that is very important, because children learn through the lens of their parents.
Sure.
Through their lens of what they see their parents do. So what the woman wears inside, what the Muslim lady wears inside the house is of utmost importance. That she doesn't wear revealing clothes in front of her little ones, right? You shouldn't go into extremes. Islam is a religion of balance and moderation. So on the one hand, you see women wearing tops and shorts and revealing clothes in front of their like 7, 8 year old sons, especially if you have a son inside your house, or some other women who go to the other end of this extreme and they cover themselves up so bad. They are reflecting a very negative image of Islam. Mm. Their daughters,
a very negative image of being woman.
Exactly. And these women, their daughters grow up to be exactly opposite of them. Mm. They say, if this is Islam,
they're resentful,
don't
yeah.
Exactly. I've seen it in my life among the people that's, you know, some of the people that I socialize with. The mom is the exact opposite of all the daughters.
Yeah, see, this is exactly what we were talking about, where it's a cultural thing, but it's not an Islamic thing. It's a culture practiced by Muslims, but it's not an Islamic culture. Nowhere in Islam tells you to cover yourself up the same in front of a mahram, the same way you would in front of a non-mahram.
Exactly.
And I think those people also are unaware. Those people also need to be educated and need to be taught.
It's an offense to their relatives who see them always covered up. It's a cultural issue of even in Iran, some parts of there are some specific cultures who are like this.
Yeah.
And I don't know what the roots of that culture is, but even like there are so many little small segments of cultures in every city. Like even in one city, there are like hundreds of different cultures, right?
True.
So you always have to keep in mind the point of moderation and balance.
Yeah.
Not to go. And these are very important, as I said, for the upbringing of your little girls.
Yeah.
So this is another point that I wanted to mention.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
There's so much more to talk about modesty and haya. And we were talking about the verses of the Quran that highlight the concept of haya. And I'm going to mention one more verse from the Noble Quran where it gives you the guideline. mm-hmm. of what if you're a Muslim mother or father, and you want to know what Islam expects of you as a Muslim woman and expects of you, your daughters, this is the guideline of, right. to be of a good woman.
Mm.
What is the criterion of being a good woman? We have talked about this verse so many times, but every time you can discuss it from a new dimension. The point is that from which direction are you looking at this verse this time? So it's verse 34 of Nisa.
Yep.
Your favorite verse. الرجال قوامون على النساء بما فضل بعضهم على بعض وبما أنفقوا من أموالهم فالصالحات قانتات حافظات. So the righteous women are obedient and they are حافظات. They are guardians. Guardians of what?
Their chastity.
One
their
of
honor.
Them is their own chastity, their own honor, and the honor and the wealth of their husbands. So here again, the Quran exactly sheds light on the fact that if you're a woman, you are supposed to be a hafiz, right?
And that's all the time we have for today's episode.
Right.
Thank you to Sister Razia for this interesting discourse. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Who is the lover?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah. Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger. To Allah is our return.
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity.
La ilaha illallah.
Muhammadur Rasulullah.
Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger, to Allah is our return.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
In the occupied Golan Heights, the population of settlers and Syrians is approximately equal. But experts fear that a new Israeli regime project will turn Syrians into a demographic minority on their own land, says Jessica Boxbaum, journalist, in an article titled, Zionist Regime is Tightening Its Grip on Syria's Golan Heights by Creating Facts on the Ground. Stay tuned for more. On December 15, 1981, the Knesset, the Zionist regime parliament, enacted a law officially annexing the Golan Heights, Syrian territory captured by the Zionist regime during 1967 Six-Day War. Now, 40 years later, the Zionist regime hopes to double the size of Jewish settlements there by the end of this decade in an effort human rights activists see as further normalizing a forgotten occupation. Last month, the Zionist regime approved a $300 million plan to promote Jewish settlement expansion in the occupied Golan Heights. In response, Adala, the Legal Center for Arab Minority Rights in the Occupied Territories, and Al-Marsad, the Arab Human Rights Center in Golan Heights, submitted a letter to Attorney General Avichai Mandelblit and the Zionist regime's Prime Minister Naftali Bennett this month, demanding the plan's cancellation, given that it is a violation of international law to build settlement on occupied land. Attempts to normalize the occupation of the Syrian Golan have no validity in international law, and the status of the Golan Heights remains occupied territory, Adala attorney Sohad Bashara said in a press release. The Zionist regime has yet to respond to the organization's letter. Currently, about 28,000 settlers reside in 34 settlements in the Golan. They operate 167 settlement businesses and control 95% of the land. The new initiative seeks to double the settler population in the Golan in 5 years by establishing two new settlements and relocating or building factories in the region. The aim is to add 23,000 settlers and construct 7,300 housing units. It also wants to boost the population of Katzrin, the largest settlement in the Golan, by 50,000 residents by 2040. The expansion of settlements in the Golan Heights not only violates the rules of international humanitarian law and human rights law, but also deepens the discriminatory reality against the natives concerning their rights to use natural resources, Al-Marsad attorney Karama Abu Saleh said. Adding, this exacerbates the situation whereby settlers have privileges in receiving budgets and access to natural resources, while the natives are suffering from land shortages and other crises. In 2019, then-President Donald Trump signed a proclamation declaring the Golan Heights as part of the fake regime of Israel. In doing so, the United States became the first country to recognize the Zionist regime's sovereignty over the occupied Syrian territory. 2 days after the Zionist regime's official annexation of the Golan Heights in 1981, the UN Security Council used Resolution 497 to determine the Knesset's Golan Heights law as null and void. Today, most of the international community considers the Golan Heights occupied. The Zionist regime decided to build a settlement in honor of Trump to be called Trump Heights as a thank you to the former president for his executive order. Trump Heights is part of the development plan to increase settler population in the Golan. While Trump's action altered the U.S. West Asia region strategy, it did not change the global status quo. Adala attorney Bishara reiterated, telling Mint Press News, the declaration of the Trump administration in this regard did not change anything on the ground. It has, of course, its international implications in terms of how Israel perceives this acknowledgement. But in terms of international law, the annexation and any recognition by any state, including the U.S., does not change the status of the area as an occupied territory and the Syrian community there as a protected community under international humanitarian law. Al-Maqsad's founder and director, Nizar Ayyub, said that Trump's declaration increased settlement activity in the Golan, with many settlements adopting expansion projects. A few years ago, settlers were around 19,000 to 20,000. Now there are about 28,000 to 29,000 settlers, Ayyub said. But Trump's decision isn't the only factor speeding up settlement expansion efforts in the Golan. The Israelis are taking advantage of the situation going on in Syria and the destruction of the Syrian state. Wael Tarabia, director of Al-Marsad's Economic, Social and Cultural Rights Program, told Mint Press News, so this is the opportunity that they are using to cement their grip on the Golan. After the Zionist regime occupied more than two-thirds of the Syrian Golan during 1967 war, 95% of the population was displaced and banned from returning. The Zionist regime forces destroyed the area's infrastructure and built settlements using the rubble from the razed villages. But the speed at which the settlements expanded was slower than what the Zionist regime hoped. The heart of the Golan is almost empty because the policy of the settlers since the occupation was to go as far as possible toward the Syrian ceasefire line and to create facts on the ground there. Today, only 27,000 Syrians remain concentrated in five villages, Majdal Shams, Bogata, Masada, Ain, Aina, and Qajar, in the northern Golan. Settlers and Syrians are approximately equal in the number now, but Al-Marsad's Tarbiya believes that the new settlement project will turn the Syrians into a demographic minority on their own land. He explained, the main point is ignored and denied all the time, which is that the other Syrians who were uprooted from their lands count at more than 500,000 and no one is talking about them. No one is talking, for example, about the right of return for the Syrians as we talk about the Palestinians. That's why we call it a forgotten occupation. And everybody is treating the Golan as if it were a normal expansion of the Israeli place. And amid the crisis in Syria, the Golan Syrians are left without a voice, Tarabia said. Because of what's happened in Syria in the last decade, the people here are helpless and they feel helpless. If you look at the local media, you will find that the reaction from the side of locals to the Israeli regime settlement plan is very few compared to what we used to see in the past years. And this explains that the people of the Golan, the Syrians, do not have any political support or representation. Despite most of the global communities recognizing the Zionist regime's occupation of the Golan Heights as a violation of international law, the oppression is largely absent from international headlines. Adala attorney Bishara surmised this is because public attention has been preoccupied with Syria's war, ongoing developments in the occupied Palestinian territories, and a raging pandemic. With the occupation of the Golan less of a violent land grab compared to the volatile situation in Palestine, the Zionist regime's injustice against Syrians gets pushed aside. as less focus is drawn to the issue from an international perspective. Within the Zionist regime's cabinets, the occupation becomes further normalized, Bashara included. It seems that the Golan Heights is becoming consensus, because even Meretz, an Israeli left-wing political party, members voted in favor of this decision, which says that there is a consensus along with the whole spectrum of the Israeli political arena, from the right wing to the so-called left Zionist parties. Golan's remaining Syrian villages control less than 4% of their own land. This is because the Zionist regime designated the occupied Golan Heights as state land, meaning the Israeli regime determines its use. While turning some of it into military training fields and outposts, other portions were allocated as nature reserves and national parks, and the largest area is reserved for settlement development. A severe housing crisis emerged out of the Israeli-made land shortage, a problem that will only be exacerbated by the settlement plan. Discriminatory land policies have made it nearly impossible for Syrians to receive building permits, forcing them to build illegally and risk demolition orders. The Zionist regime authorities have issued 1,570 demolition orders since its annexation of the Golan. As a result, many Syrians have had to pay exorbitantly high fines, go to prison, or have their homes demolished. Al-Marsat Tarbiya speculated the settlement expansion plan may benefit local construction businesses, but overall, the Syrian Golanese economy will suffer. The economic situation will become worse and worse with time, Tarbiya said, explaining how, along with settlement growth, the Zionist regime hopes to transform the Golan Heights into the Zionist regime's renewable energy capital. Last year, the Zionist regime approved a plan to build a giant wind farm on a fifth of the Syrian agricultural land in the Golan, significantly harming the natives' health, environment, and economy, and depleting their natural resources. Tarbiya said, "That's why people feel that they can do nothing. We are a few people without any kind of support." But he argued that the Syrian communities are not in regular confrontation with the settlers, but rather the Zionist regime is their main source of friction. When we talk about the housing crisis, people don't connect it directly to the settlers. They connect it to the policies of the Zionist regime, because we deal with the Zionist policies and Zionist authorities, Tarbiya said. They are the ones who reject our need to expand the villages.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.